Okay, so I've resisted Parthas trying to get me to do neuroscience, and I finally gave up. So last week I started doing neuroscience, and this is what I've learned. Okay, so this paper is actually appearing online today, supposedly, and it's no longer embargoed, but that stuff, I don't get it anyway. So this is a paper which is an attempt to make a connection, and it got started. Oh, it's on the wiki too. So the papers I'm going to talk about are on the KTP neuroscience wiki. So we're trying to connect neuroscience. One of the things that neuroscience has just started using is robust control theory. Particular Daniel Wolpert at Cambridge has started to use that stuff that we worked on in the 80s. But I want to try to make connections with that. Also, talk about robustness, organization, and architecture, but also the fact that a lot of this is hidden. And so a lot of the most important features of the brain or the most important features of the internet or your laptop or whatever are hidden, or your automobile these days. Okay, so the starting point was I went to a Sackler symposium at which I've known Eve Marder for a while, and I like Eve Marder, and then there's this guy Dale Purvis there, and he was talking about illusions, and Eve was talking about circuits. So what is Eve? So I got interested in illusions basically from Dale. I thought they were really fun, and so you saw me showing some more. We'll get, but he really talks about the fact that we shouldn't call these illusions. These are our brain properly interpreting a 3D world, and we never were selected to look at PowerPoint slides. Who cares, right? So I was inspired by that, and I was also inspired by some stuff in this lobster circuit, that these networks were large, thin, and non-convex, which seemed to be a puzzle, and what I'm going to say is neither the illusions nor this large, thin, non-convex feature of circuits is, and by the way, the terminology is a disaster, okay? So throughout, the terminology will be terrible. So don't, and I really apologize for that. One of the things we need to work on. So these papers are also online, so if you want to see how this kind of connects. But so I'm not going to talk about non-convex very much, even though that's by far the most important feature. I will say what I mean by large and thin. So what I'm going to claim is that this large, thin, non-convex feature isn't an accident. It's an absolute necessity, and so are the illusions. The illusions are an absolute necessity as a side effect, and we'll try to talk about that. So last week was awesome. Helen Mayberg, lots of block diagrams like this. So engineers love block diagrams. And then this is parts of the brain, and she was interested in using deep brain stimulation to treat depression. It's been used a lot already to treat chronic pain. And you just have, this stuff's all online, you gotta see it. It's just amazing some of the stuff that they do. But they do a lot of these block diagrams, and these are layered architectures, and we talked a lot last week about layered architectures. Of course, they wanna connect the boxes with the actual brain. Not for me. I like the boxes, but there's lots of you can, you know, spend a lot of time. They'll translate the boxes into the brain. So I'm interested in why are the boxes like this? Why are these architectures layered? And then Paul gave an interesting talk, not very comprehensible in my opinion, but. but nevertheless, fabulous. So I hope I'm not gonna follow in his footsteps on the incomprehensible stuff. But what I understood was great, and there was a lot I didn't understand. So again, layering, he's got these layers of soma, reactive, adaptive, contextual in the brain. And then he talks about another dimensions of layering, which is your interactions with sensing, your internal, and then your action in the world. And he, like me and like many people, but not everyone, thinks that the brain is primarily evolved to do action. And then he talks about levels of consciousness, and so he's layering it in many dimensions. He's taking the brain and taking a lot of different ways of layering it, and I want to try to say, are there any layered systems in which we know everything you can know about them? And that's what we're going to try to talk about. So two words that are misused, laws and architectures. And so I will try to misuse them too. So theory of hard limits and constraints, which you might call laws, conservation laws, but laws is one of these overloaded words, and so it's really constraints. Constraints is the word that I prefer. And then a theory of architecture. Architecture is a word we use all the time, and we never define it, and the people who like to use it a lot in engineering are very mystical, and they get paid a lot of money. So if you're an architect for Cisco, right, you can own a 10-acre farm in Goleta, right? And so, but they won't tell you, how they do what they do. You can hire them for an infinite amount of money. Lots of case studies. We'll talk about some of these. Okay. So some of the terminology I'll use, this is also on the wiki, is in a paper that appeared last year. I'm going to talk a lot about robustness and fragility. So what I want to do is concretely, in terms, I'm going to try to be really concrete, because we need to develop a better terminology. And what ends up happening is we talk past each other because we already have all our favorite abstractions. So I'm going to try to get rid of the abstractions and talk concretely. So humans have incredibly robust metabolisms. We can regenerate and repair moderate damage and heal a wound and infection. And all of this evolved. It was interesting. There's a really interesting story, which I'm not going to get into today, but it's been recently, in the last just 10 years, really come together. The extent to which our entire physiology is driven by technology. You know, it's 2-million-year-old technology. But we're runners, we're throwers, we use fire, we have small guts, we can't eat raw food. I mean, it's all of our physiology. Everything about our physiology is really driven by technology, and we're very different from our nearest primate cousins. But at the same time, in a modern environment, we have obesity, diabetes, cancer, autoimmune inflammation. And so you could ask, okay, what's going on here? And of course, the answer is there's a gene for everything, and that's not the way we're going to go. The idea is that you've got these mechanisms, right? I'm interested in physiological mechanisms, fat accumulation, insulin resistance, improper cell proliferation, and inflammation is part of everything. And so inflammation is underlying all of these things. Okay. So these are the mechanisms responsible for this. So you might ask, what's responsible for that? Same thing. Fat accumulation when appropriate, insulin resistance getting turned on and off all the time, appropriate cell proliferation, and inflammation is crucial in all of these things. So the mechanisms are the same. So what's really the difference here? What's the difference, and is this an accident or a necessity? So the difference is, in a fluctuating energy environment, that is when you're putting out a lot of energy in a fluctuating way and you're taking in a lot of energy in a fluctuating way, particularly when starvation is always right around the corner, then these things are great. They're incredibly robust mechanisms. However, you put that in a modern, sort of highly virtualized environment where we don't have to get our own food and we can eat as much as we want, et cetera, et cetera. Then the same things are a disaster. And so the idea is that what you want is over here, these are controlled and dynamic. They have low mean, typically low mean, but they come on and off. Okay? What happens over here is they become uncontrolled and chronic. But it's the same underlying processes, it's just whether they're controlled or not. So I know some doctors who say, we'll cure all of these before we'll understand any one of them in detail. Right? And you do that by shifting back to this. And how do you do that? Well, like your mom said, you eat right and exercise, but there's probably other things you can do. So again, the mechanism. So here's a block diagram for some of that. This is just the stoichiometry of a few things. But there's no control in this, and this is all the simple part. But this whole system evolved for really large energy variation and moderate amounts of trauma, sort of the kind of trauma that doesn't get you in an intensive care unit. So if you get that kind of trauma again 2 million years ago, you were dead. And actually, until about 10 years ago, you were dead. So one of the things that happens in these pictures is, if you read papers in biology, they always start out with this. You have some source and you have some receiver, that might be signaling, gene expression, metabolism, lineages. First paper looks like this. And that would be this part, right? A bunch of arrows. Then what happens is, next paper, next paper, next paper, next paper, next paper. Pretty soon all the arrows are going the other way, right? And that's the way it always is. That's the way the internet works. That's the way your body works, that's the way your cells work, that's the way your brain works. So what's the consequences of some of this? Let me give you a first cut, a little bit of mechanism of this robustness and fragility. So, and this is our first glimpse at layering. So we're going to take a quick look at layering through this setting. So we have this sort of universal metabolic, all sorts of stuff we can eat, all sorts of stuff we make from what we eat, and there's a few sort of intermediate building blocks. We turn everything into this, and this is how we build everything. Okay. So this is our layers. So you have the intake part, you have the movement around part, the building block part, and then you have the polymerization and anabolic part. Very efficient to do it this way. So our physiologies are incredibly efficient. From an engineering point of view, spectacularly efficient. Quite robust. You can have a really highly variable supply. We're omnivores. We can eat damn near anything, and you're showing us that right now. We also can supply extremely variable demand. You know, these people who are doing the Tour de France are burning 10,000 calories a day. No problem. Of course, they don't live very long. Highly evolvable, extremely evolvable, right? If you need to be able to eat something new, you don't have to, you just plug in some catabolic process. Incredibly evolvable. Bacteria do this a lot better than we do, but so we have an evolving diet, we can have evolving function. So so these kinds of architectures accelerate evolvability because I can make a change out here and don't have to change anything else. So I can make very large changes that are likely to be functional. So evolution does not occur by, you know, small accumulation of increments. It can occur by really large changes because of the architecture. And Gerhardt and Kirshner.
Why did you say that bacteria can do it much better?
Oh, we'll get to bacteria. Bacteria kick our asses on practically everything, but they made us, so kind of, I think, as a joke. So what you got is these conserved core building blocks. These have been conserved more or less for certainly a billion years. Glucose longer, but glucose and oxygen, certainly a billion years. Okay. We also have another system, which looks similar in architecture, but different in components. And this is the reward system. So food gives us a little squirt of dopamine. So I learned last week, actually I heard this before, learned last week, I don't actually care about anything except a little squirt of dopamine. So I may say I like you, but all I'm doing is, so I hang out with Scott because I get dopamine, right? Yeah, anyway. So it's incredibly evolved, there's other things too, incredibly evolvable. So we can learn, or we can quickly evolve to like these things, right? Somehow, I have this gene that likes math. Weird, huh? So you got this reward drive control. It's incredibly robust and incredibly evolvable. Super, super evolvable. Because again, you can just plug anything in here, right? Plug anything you want in, you can evolve very quickly because you're plugging into an existing system. So we got these two, and they work together. Sometimes food goes to both of them. We get a squirt of dopamine, and we get glucose and oxygen. Well, oxygen is part of the problem. There's a phrase for this, I really like, Gerhardt and Kirshner.
Actually, I would not put dopamine there as a molecule, but general principle.
Yeah.
It's okay, there is debate about.
Yeah, there's all sorts of, yeah. That's why I said there's lots of other molecules. Yeah, there's lots of other molecules. If you know how this works, you know a lot more about how to fill this in. And again, there's lots more than this, right?
The distinction between seeking and satiation.
Yeah, so we talked a lot about homeostasis and allostasis, but I'm not going to get into that today. This is oversimplified. But here's the idea, is that constraints that deconstrain. It's a nice phrase. It's biologists came up with this. And what do they mean by it? They mean constraints. You're stuck with this. You know, we've been doing this for a long time. You can't change these things, right? We're built out of fish parts, right? And but this is sort of modularity 2.0, the idea that you have these constraints and then they deconstrain. What do I mean by that? It means that once you accept these constraints, that you're gonna use blood, you're gonna use glucose and oxygen, right? Then you incredibly deconstrain what you can do here and what you can do here, and they're all independent, right? Because they just have to match at the interface. Okay. So this is called a bow tie, and it's just because it looks like a bow tie. And it's only in the sense of diversity, right? Very diverse, very diverse. There's lots of this stuff in the body, right? It's not that this is not a lot of stuff. It's a conceptual diagram and therefore misleading. All these cartoons are misleading, but this is a layered architecture, right? You have a catabolic layer, you have these universal building blocks, and then you have an anabolic layer. Okay, robust and adaptive. So another term of this is weak linkage, right? These things are not directly connected to these. That's sort of modularity 1.0. That's the easy side of modularity. The hard part of modularity is how it's enabled by this part, right? So the most important modules, which is these, are not weakly connected, right, to the others. They're strongly connected to everything. So if you're trying to, you know, pull these out of a graph, you're gonna lose, right? You want the most connected things. Okay. But there's problems, right? Because cocaine and amphetamines can bypass all of this. So now you can not worry about those anymore, right? Or you can do these, and there's all sorts of stuff you can replace it with that we weren't evolved to handle. You can create industrial agriculture to pump us with all this stuff. We have a market consumer culture that hijacks the same thing. So what you're seeing is you're seeing the hijacking of a robust system, and you start doing all that stuff over the internet. And pretty soon, all hell breaks loose, right? So pretty soon, you have all this stuff, you know. So you have modern life. So it's robust, right? But it's also incredibly fragile. And the point is, it's the same stuff, right? It's how it's controlled that matters, not the stuff itself. And it's that the worst fragilities we have are not when we get smashed, it's when we get hijacked, right? What's the problem with the internet, right? Is you get spam. It works. Nobody goes and breaks the internet. They just send you crap, right? You leave everything intact and you hijack it. What do viruses do? They hijack, right? You may die as a consequence, but that's not what they care about, right? That's a side effect. Too bad. Okay, so we have this. We also have lots of microbial symbionts, really crucial ones, and we get parasites, but they also cause parasite infection. So we have this very complex neuroendocrine system, right? But we have addiction, psychosis, and so on. So we create complex societies, but then we have epidemics, war, monotheism, masculinity. We create these advanced technologies, right? But then we have disasters and global anything. Put anything in here: warming, water, like, right? And by the way, I'm kind of a skeptic on this stuff, a little bit. It's way worse than anybody's telling you. Risk management, right? Oh, we're doing advanced risk management, right? And so what we're actually doing are obfuscating and amplifying. Okay, so the point is, these fragilities are the hijacking side effects of the unintended consequences, right? They're not a gene, right? G-E-N-E, gene. But of mechanisms that really evolve for robustness in the first place, the biggest fragilities are the side effects of the biggest robustness. And the complexity is in controlling all of this and in managing these trade-offs. If you don't manage these trade-offs well, you die. And the math is that there's conservationals. Again, I put this in quotes because I don't like this term, and we'll say a little bit about what those are. So the idea is that, must you have fragility if you have robustness? Is it a necessity or an accident? Well, it's both, right? There's necessary hard trade-offs. For example, conservation of energy. If you don't understand conservation of energy in material, in small moieties, the complexity of metabolism is bewildering. Right? Why all these wires, right? Oh, energy is conserved. Oh, okay. Of course, we take that for granted. If you don't understand robustness conservation, you're as bewildered by these problems. So it's a necessity, but it's also accident, because it's an accident how it plays out. It's the interaction between some evolve for one environment, and then the environment changes in ways that, of course, we changed the environment, but the environment changes in ways that we weren't evolved to handle. So the details are all accident. And there are frozen accidents in evolution. I mean, the fact that we got built out of fish parts, like this whole thing with the bones in our ears used to be fish jaws. It's unbelievable stuff. Pretty good hack, but still a hack. Okay. So this is a paper that's just appeared in Science, 8th July, which tries to take the simplest, this paper took me 10 years to write, the simplest possible story. But we took on an old ancient mystery, glycolytic oscillation. So this is what I'm going to talk about at some point. So we'll come back to that. So how do you fix this? Well, the issue is architecture. Architecture is the heart of this. Of course, there's the, don't worry, there's an app for that, right? The rapture is near. Here's the gopher rapture. We found the gene, we'll do the, or the market will, whatever. Ah, there's a new science of networks or a new science of complexity. My favorite is like order for free. Like, dude, man, it's like order for free. This is, I think, what Partha was referring to earlier. Or just like, dude, like, chill. Okay, so I'm worried. And this is a big thing. So this was, actually I made this slide up before last week, but last week nailed this slide, right? We live in this virtual world, right? We don't have to make our own food. When we flush our toilets, who knows where it goes, right? We turn the tap on. We live in this incredibly virtualized world. In that virtualized world, we can think about information and computation and learning and decisions, stuff like that. But in the real world, all that matters is action. And that's what the brain has evolved to do. All these things are intermediate stages. Now, engineers will try to convince you that this is what you really want. And don't worry about the real world, right? What could go wrong? I mean, what could go wrong with us pumping all this carbon into the atmosphere? Don't worry, right? So action doesn't matter. So this is a typical cartoon of that this wasn't shown last week, but this would be a typical kind of cartoon you would see that has reaction, spinal cord, no brain here. This is just a spinal cord. Let me just do a cartoon of this. So so you got this big honking, thick myelinated fibers that when you touch something, you withdraw. Okay, just goes to the spine. And you have no clue why that happened. In fact, you have no clue for quite a while because that's coming by other wires, really slowly. So from a computer science point of view or a information theory point of view, this is incredibly stupid. You're devoting all your resources for one bit of information. Boom. Incredibly stupid. Except that doing this quickly, it's more important for you to act than to know why. Okay. You'll know why eventually. You'll know it was either a burn or a cut or something. You'll find out eventually. But if you wait to find out why, you're dead. So we devote, all of our brain is organized this way. To sense and move and do so quickly. Everything else, not important. So we call this reflex and reflect. Okay. But Scott says, that ain't to scale. It's more like that. What we think of as our conscious mind is a really thin veneer on that, right? So now that I got to know Scott, I think that's true of Scott, but I'm back here. No, I'm kidding. So I've learned a lot from talking to Scott and Mike over the last year, and I'd say something like, oh, no, that's way wrong. Go read this and listen to Mike's podcasts and stuff. So this is the problem. And the problem is reflection won't let you understand this. Okay. And what I want to say is that this is not an accident of history. This is how you have to build robust control systems. You have no choice. You must build it this way. We're going to have to build everything this way. So how do we fix this mess? We have to understand that what matters is action. We probably have to automate a lot of stuff that we now take for granted, right? So for example, you don't decide how to get your packets to their destination when you send an email. Somebody takes care of that. You probably shouldn't worry about that for transportation. You should say, here's where I want to go, and you don't own any vehicles that get you there, and there's a packet switch network that gets you there, so on. But we also have to understand the reason we're doing that is because there's hard limits and hard trade-offs. Okay. So we want want to avoid is we got this world in which what we have built is fragile, slow, and wasteful, or at least two of those three. So what are the fundamentals? So this paper, by the way, all the papers that I'm showing you are written to really be for a completely general audience. So the idea is that, so if an intelligent sixth grader walked in, they wouldn't get lost. We want to be robust and efficient, right? So I'm going to think of our systems as living in these two dimensions. We want to have robust systems. We don't want to be fragile. We don't want to be wasteful, right? But the problem is we get kind of one or the other, right? In fact, again, is this really robustness? Very, very narrow view of robustness. Probably makes more fragilities than it solves, right? But it's clearly wasteful. Mostly we get neither, right? So the question is, how do we attack this? There's a gap between what we'd like to do. Is it bad theory? Is it bad architecture? It's all of the above. So what's our theories? We have these the 20th century delivered us on incredibly stovepipe theories. I was going to do this whole thing with climbing trees to get to the moon because I think that's a good analogy, but we all got our own little trees we're climbing in. These are very deep. These names are among, you know, the 20th century's greatest minds, but fragmented and completely incoherent. The assumptions they make are incompatible about how the world works. So more or less, here's a way of thinking about it. It's kind of a cartoon, but each theory kind of has one dimension, and the important trade-offs are across these dimensions. So project is encouraging, and so I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about the attempt to get, and I think it's quite reasonable to think that we could have two theories instead of four, but I'm not sure about one. So what we want to do is we want to say there's actually conservation. So each one of these has their own conservation laws, right? But it's the mixture of the two. So the conservation laws, if you take those theories, you say, oh, well, we can't be any more than perfectly efficient, and we can't be any more than perfectly robust, and there's a rigorous definition of that. But can we get here? Well, no, you can't get there. And the question is, where can we get? And then can we find systems on the boundary? Yes, we can. We can find some systems that sit on the boundary, not many of the ones we build. And then the other thing you can do is, even if you don't know where this stuff is, you can find and fix bugs. I mean, there's so much wrong with what we do that we're doing so much badly in technology that we can fix a lot of things without knowing what the ultimate limits are, right? So if your steam engine is 1% efficient, you can make a lot of improvements without knowing what 100% is, right? And that was how things started. Here's an example of, I think, ways you can make progress. So turbulence is a big problem in all sorts of inefficiencies. And so, and I'm not going to say much about this. Bassam's probably here. This is really based on his work from the 90s. Denise just graduated, going to Hopkins. Beverly is a experimentalist at Caltech. And Tonis is at Oxford. And so the big mystery here, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but the idea is that a huge mystery is that even in fully developed turbulence, there's these large coherent structures. Where do they come from? And that paper says where they come from. But I want to use turbulence as a little bit of a case study here, because as you well know, turbulence is a highly nonlinear phenomenon. What does that actually mean? Well, usually when people say that, they don't mean not linear. They mean, I don't understand this, but I don't want to just say I don't understand it. So, what can I say? I'll say something that sounds like profound. It's a highly nonlinear phenomenon, right? Well, it's not highly nonlinear. Where's the not, that little u dot delta u? Come on, that's not highly nonlinear. That's a pretty mild one, right? Now the turbulent blunting is due to that nonlinearity. Right? But there's no reason to be scared of it, right? So there's two kinds of complexity I want to talk about here. And this is, I've been trying to figure out how to explain this, and this will be another bad attempt. So the idea is that if you take Navier-Stokes and you take 2D and linear, or probably 2D and nonlinear, it's pretty simple. You can prove global results, you can do all sorts of stuff with it, right? But if you go 3D nonlinear, it goes from robust to extremely fragile. In fact, we don't even know some of the most basic mathematical properties of these equations we don't know. So even though the model stays simple, I mean, what could be simpler, right? I can write it down in two lines, provided you know what the symbols mean. But still, there's few models more elegant or more simple in nature, or our descriptions in nature, right? But if you go to 3D knowledge systems, all hell breaks loose. This thing becomes very unpredictable, okay? But there's another direction you can go, and this is, I call this mildly nonlinear. What's highly nonlinear? Well, this computer's highly nonlinear. You can build a robust system that doesn't have a simple model. There's billions of transistors here running in hard saturation. That's highly nonlinear. Okay. Now the point is, we can run this on this, and for a lot of fluid problems, it's a huge advance. Was for a lot of fluid problems, the difference between your simulation and various experimental attempts to build the same thing, the difference between the simulation and the experiments is as small as the difference between the experiments and each other. So there's a whole lot of problems in fluids in which legitimately you can say, well, I'm not even going to study fluids, I'm just going to study this simulation. A huge advance, but it also suggests that simulating is not understanding, because you can still get a simulation. You basically now, you instead of having an experiment you don't understand, you have a simulation you don't understand, right? Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a gap between this and reality. I'm just saying that this is complicated enough that if we put it on computers, we can make simulations that we don't understand. Okay. Now, trivially, the computer is more complex than the thing it's simulating, because we can simulate something else, right? This is highly nonlinear. This kind of complexity subsumes this kind of complexity, but not the other way around. You can't, as far as I know, run this on that, right? We'd like to, they're cool. Okay. And then there's this irreducible complexity when you're really in trouble, right? And that's where we want to stay away from. That's the nightmare that we want to avoid. We want to build big systems that are incredibly fragile. That's what we want to avoid. So here's the latest paper in this genre, Physics of Fluids, just appeared. Same cast of characters. And the point is, what causes this drag? And it turns out the coherent structures do. So we've tied not only why are there coherent structures, but why the coherent structures produce turbulent drag. And the nice thing about this, if we had time, you can actually have intuition about this. You can sort of hand wave your way and get some intuition about where turbulent drag comes from. So it first involved bringing new mathematics to it. But once the mathematics was done, we can go back and tell stories with cartoons. Okay, So we can fix things without knowing the ultimate limits by just figuring. So again, what is understanding to an engineer? We want to fix this. We want to get rid of turbulence. We don't want to just understand it. We want to remove it. So we need an explanation that is leading towards control. And that's what Beverly really cares about. Beverly really cares about controlling turbulence. She's a turbulence experimentalist. She wants to stop it. She wants to control it. She wants to amplify it sometimes, because sometimes it's a good thing. And so she wants to control it. And the kind of understanding you need for controlling it is different than what you need to simulate. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to just this case talk about this story, and again I'm going to kind of be a little superficial here. The paper, like I said, the paper is there, and this is written. Like I said, the 10 years has been trying to get it so that it's acceptable in this journal, which doesn't let you do any math. So there's almost no math in this paper, but even so, science has never published anything like this before, so they had to take a deep breath and take a gulp and say, we just got to do this. I will show you some of the reviews in a little bit. But anyway, the reviewers we ended up with were wonderful. So, universal issues. So the point is, another bad word. I got to stop using that. Confuses the hell out of people. Long-standing mystery, maybe millennia. The nice thing is we understand all the components work, and again, we have simulations that completely reproduce the experiments. So the issue isn't can we simulate the phenomena, is do we understand it? Okay. So what is it? It's glycolytic oscillations. Okay, and let me just try to say what these are. So these are experiments. So these are actually in extracts, and so the idea is that it's well enough understood that you can make cell-free extracts that oscillate. And what's oscillating here, it turns out what's really cool is NADH naturally fluoresces, so you can see these oscillations. And you get a nice classic Hopf bifurcation, and there's all sorts of models. Been studied to death. The thing has been carpet bombed, right? And the people who work on this are very sophisticated, so if you tell them something new, they get it. They get it like that. Okay, so here's what we told them is new. Okay, that's the This is sort of a standard simulation. So the model I'm going to talk about does this, if you put it in the regime of the extracts, okay? So there isn't any mystery about, you can simulate it, you can do it in extracts, you can probably take purified proteins and get it to work. I mean, you can get this to do, this is easy to get to do. The question is why, right? And we want a deep why. We don't want a why like, oh, PFK is regulated by blah, 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 right? Okay, so why? So we have a story which says that there's a hard trade-off. One of the mysteries is why are the enzymes so complex and so on. There's a theorem. So it turns out this is the simplest example of this theorem there is, but you have to know a lot about chemistry. So it turns out we can map it onto an old problem in engineering, which is linearized pendulum on a cart. So I'm going to do it first, and then you're going to do it. So here's the idea. So what you want to do is you want to stabilize this, and it's hard to stabilize it up. It's easy to stabilize it down. Why? Okay? Turns out there's a translation, more or less, the math translates. So there's autocatalysis here, that's up. There's complex versus simple enzymes, that's using your eyes or not using your eyes. And so there's autocatalysis and complex enzymes in this, and we'll try to. So there's a direct mapping mathematically. This is not as interesting. I mean, this is really interesting. But, oh, by the way, see, like, the red arrows are control. The control is where all the complexity is. Okay, so here's the idea. It's easy even with my eyes closed. So what I want to do is I want to move the tip of the stick around to be wherever I want. Really easy, okay? And I know that N of 1 isn't good, so we'll do an N of 2 in a second. Okay. And there's a theorem that says, turns out you'll see it oscillates a little bit when I move, right? And there's a theorem that says that it oscillates a little bit. Not much, a little bit. Okay.
What's G?
That's frequency. Yeah, I'm not even going to tell you about this, so I apologize. So the idea is that...
J.
Oh, that's the square root of minus... Engineers use J as the square root of minus 1.
Yeah.
So, anyway. So the point is, there's a hard limit on how robust you can be, and we'll see it in more graphic. And if you do it with a quality, then you have fragile robustness. But you can have gratuitous fragility. You can have this really be bad, and the cell doesn't do that. Okay. Up is harder. Okay, so up is harder. And notice, I can't get rid of the oscillations. There's no purpose to these oscillations. I would just as happy just balance it perfectly without oscillations. And if people get, and if you shorten the stick, it gets harder and harder. I can't get anybody to do this, so I have to do it. So you can do it still. It's getting harder, right? Whoa. Okay. Okay. And then pretty soon it's completely hopeless. Okay. Now the theorem changes. This integral, again, think of this integral as net robustness or entropy difference or whatever different thing you want to think. It's just sort of the net robustness of the system. To those who know about this, it would be the... It's, if you take any kind of disturbance to my hand or to the tip and looked at all frequency, then the integral of the log across all frequency is bounded by some constant. And that constant goes up as p gets small. If I want p small, then I make l large. The nice thing is you can work this out all analytically. So the point is, we can trace the intrinsic difficulty of the control problem, independent of how I do it. This has nothing to do with how I implement the control. This is true if I do it with a robot, right? The difference in the robot has less delay than me, but it's still hard, okay? So it gets harder. Why are there oscillations? So there's this picture. As I get so here's my fragility. My fragility goes down. My net fragility goes down as the length gets longer. So I get a curve like this. And why are there oscillations? There's no purpose. It's just a side effect. Okay. And again, the paper explains this in more detail. Actually, the paper on the wiki, the PNAS paper on the wiki, has an appendix on exactly this. So you can look at both of them. Okay. Now here's the thing: is eyes closed. I'm not going to close my eyes. All I'm going to do is have my eyes move down. So I'm going to look lower and lower and lower, and it becomes hopeless. Okay? So we're going to do an N of 2. So I want you to balance it and then move your eyes down. once you get it balanced. She was the only person I could get to even do it at all. Okay. So the idea is, again, it doesn't, in some sense, it does depend a little bit on who's doing it. So, and I've got a lot of brain damage, as you probably guessed. And so I was surprised that I was able to do it. But I spend hours every day practicing this. Not really. But. Okay, so the idea is that if your eyes are closed, it's completely hopeless. This thing just blows up on you, right? So what ends up happening is you get a picture like this. You're so fragile no matter what you do, no matter what you do, you're so fragile you can't control. It's more or less, you can't control. It's not speed of response, because okay. So this more or less maps onto this glycolytic oscillations case. And what it corresponds to is, one of the mysteries was, actual genome mystery, was some of the intermediate enzymes are gratuitously complex, it would appear. What they are doing is doing the equivalent of eyes. Okay. It's giving you a different sensor that you didn't have. And biology goes to a lot of trouble to do fancy sensing, right? Its vision is a very versatile sensor. Really amazing. Okay.
What do you mean by simple versus complex enzymes?
Just how honking big are they, right? And they have allosteric regulators, and so big machines as opposed to little simple machines. So these are different architectures at the circuit level. So there's simple enzyme and complex enzyme. So it's not exactly the same, but you have the same sort of trade-offs. And it does have this theorem, and it's all there in the paper. So, and it's also, it's really intended to be accessible. I mean, it's as accessible as it possibly can be. I mean, that's as much math as there is, and this is all undergraduate stuff. I mean, all the proofs are stuff that you'd all be familiar with, because it would be like contour integrals and stuff like that, really easy stuff. Too fragile. Again, just side effects of hard trade-offs. So interesting about the biology is, so you can think about this as sort of the enzyme amount, and so there's a rate constant that depends on how much enzyme there is. So it turns out in the natural cell, it varies by orders of magnitude. So the levels of enzymes in cells are not controlled very accurately, generally. Very stochastic. Okay, there's a lot of cell-to-cell variability. So I was going to show you the data, but we actually look at the, and it's like this orders of magnitude range. And then the cells that are down here are a little more fragile than the others, and so here's what, and intact cells do this. They don't really oscillate, they just kind of ring a little bit. How do you get those? You got to beat the crap out of them. It's easier to kill them than to get them to oscillate. That's why, it turns out again in retrospect, one of the reasons the extracts oscillate so well is because you can exactly control the conditions in ways that are completely unnatural. So this is sort of like, I don't know, putting yeast in a modern environment, it's in the lab. So the idea is that, so I showed you, so there's a conservation law. Again, it's a constraint. I don't know what the right word to call it. It's like conservation of energy, but and the point is, depending on the architecture, you're really stuck. What a good architecture does is let you kind of move along, sometimes being more robust, sometimes being more efficient. Okay. The problem is, this is all phenomenological. The description here is all phenomenological. What would viewers say? Simply wrong. Simply wrong. Cannot be done. So here's the problem. While the notion of universality is well justified in physics, and I go, oh, shit, totally different notion, right? Has nothing to do with this. My notion of universal, just the ordinary universal, it always holds, right? Just always holds.
So yeah, let me comment about that, because I think this misunderstanding that has been going on, which can be explained with at least one simple example that both sides can understand, which is in physics, the universality arises from symmetry principles, which lead to conservation laws. And they are just, you know, statements about nature. In the kind of universality that's there in engineering or in biology, is of a different sort.
Very different sort. But like conservation of energy matters to biology.
Right, but I think I realize that a good example is the Turing machine, because what it is saying is there is a notion of universality in engineering, which says that You can build many Turing machines.
That's another different notion.
Sorry.
Let's wait on this, because that's another notion of universality.
No, wait. So the point is that there's a notion in engineering which is different.
And this is different from that.
There's no symmetry principle involved there.
It's just that there's
one machine that can...
Yeah, so universality is one of those words that means five different things to, you know, and if you ask five theorists, you'll get 10 answers. And so, got to find a different word
it's
for it.
It's just that people say universal Turing machine.
I know, and even that is different than what I mean here. I mean universal here in just a really stupid way. Conservation of energy always holds. This law always holds. It doesn't matter if it's my hand, it doesn't matter if it's the cell, it always, really more. It doesn't mean anything fancy, right? It just means always there. So I should just say always there, not use universal, because universal gets people all worked up. The author does not seem to have an understanding or appreciation of the vast diversity of biological and physiological systems. Makes the model useless without any real connection. Anyway, you get the point. So the point is, these people don't change their minds. They have no clue what I'm talking about, right? They will not let you publish. And so how do you get your papers published? How do you get grants? You have to make sure these people don't get asked. Some of you may be in this room. So here's a problem. One of the problems is this axis, this fragility robustness axis, is general rigorous and really first principles. This one's not. I mean, I don't think the biochemists' stories that they tell us about enzymes are wrong. They're just phenomenological. Okay, they're domain specific, ad hoc, and phenomenological. Can we fix that? Right? Could we make this as rigorous as this? And I think that's possible. So, but I'm not going to talk much about it. What you have to do is kind of redo all this stuff. Right? Where does noise come from? Where does dissipation come from? Where does amplification come from? And so here's a paper that starts that. And again, you probably have seen this before, but it's a completely different way of doing it. So the problem is, this is in a steady state, but it's not approaching any kind of thermodynamic equilibrium. I got to do work just to do this, and it's not work in any usual sense, right? But eventually, of course, if you wait long enough, I will die, and it'll go to a thermodynamic equilibrium, right? But the maintenance of this, and the energy, the work I have to do to maintain this, we don't have a good theory for. Well, we're starting to. But it's a lot of stuff to do. This is kind of a hobby. Okay. Bacteria. Let me skip bacteria, because we're kind of running out of time. Bacteria are the most kick-ass example of layered architectures. Totally, they're the best, okay? So if we had time, I would do it all with that, but I'm going to do it something simpler. Oh, you see these bow ties, right? All over the place, right? You have, let's go on. So I want an example of layering so these are all good examples. Lego's a really good example. Money's a good example. Cell biology's the best example. But clothing. We're going to quickly do clothing. This is soft layering. So the idea is that you layer your outfits, right? So what's the modularity here? We want to understand. So we have a modularity 1.0 and a modularity 2.0. So given a wardrobe or set of garments, right? So walk into your wardrobe. There's a virtually infinite number of different outfits you can make out of a large wardrobe, right? I don't have a large wardrobe, but you know people do, right? But so the number of outfits is large. But it's a very thin set within the sets of all things that you can do with the clothes. Like you just pile them on the floor. This is what I'm a specialist in. Is you pile them on the floor, and you can pile them in an infinitely greater number than the ones that actually work, right? So this number is huge by comparison. So this is just large, and this is thin. We should be talking about co-dimension and stuff, but let's not do that. We'll just say large and thin. So the point is, all functional systems are large and thin, and there's no contradiction, right? If you look at it from this side, oh man, there's tons of outfits. Or you look from this side, but no random outfit, no random collection of garments in any position is going to be an outfit. Zero probability. So this is a set of measure zero that is nevertheless huge. And so Eve Marr's paper says these neuron networks are huge numbers of different things work, but they're basically a set of measure zero. So everything's like that. They're also non-convex. That's actually a problem. Okay. Like, right. You can't, like, so if you take Legos and you make a pile of them and you drop Legos on and make a Lego pile, at no point does it get to some sort of critical state that makes you there's never, you know, so this is the climate, like trying to get the moon by climbing trees. So this, I mean, I love this phrase, is wonderful, right? You know, Stuart Kaufman talking about, it's like, dude, and like hanging out with Stuart talking about this stuff is so fun. It's just not true. So here's another case, nine letters, adegonors, right? There's like that many sequences of nine letters. That's enough to make the whole language, right? We could just make it out of those letters by just rearranging them. It'd be a little hard to learn, but only organize is a word in here. Check that, right? Good example of what computers do really easily and we do really badly. So that's another. So the number of words is huge, right? But it's a very thin set in the set of all non-words. And again, you can correlate things. In fact, Shannon did his original paper. It's very cute to show that you can get a lot of wordy looking things and you can get a lot of languagey looking things, but you never actually get closer to language in some sense, although you might be happy with Chomsky. Okay, so here's layering. You got your skin. You got, so by the way, I'm thinking not Santa Barbara. Let's think Alaska, right? Let's think, 100,000 years ago, we invaded Europe. Well, not us, but, well, I guess, yeah, us. Most of us. So you got this really fragile skin, right? Now, this skin is awesome at the equator. It sweats, so you can run anything. So we can run down, at the equator, we can run down a horse. No problem. So you need something nice to keep you want to get warm, protection, and then something nice and comfortable next to your skin. So you know you go to REI and you can buy all this stuff for arbitrary amounts of money. The point is, it all has to stay hidden, right? From your skin, you don't want to see anything but this. And if it kind of pops through, you chafe, right? But also from out here, again, this is, you know, think of the Arctic or Antarctica. You don't want to see that either, right? So this is a really robust architecture. You can build, once you have a wardrobe, appropriate wardrobe, you can be robust to weather, activity, appearance requirements, wear and tear, clean, and stuff. Of course, if it's Southern California, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff. Especially if you're at Caltech, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff, right? Okay, but there's more to this, right? There's an hourglass, and I want to talk about that. This is modularity 1.0, right? This is modularity 2.0. So what happens is you make fiber into thread, the cloth, the garments. Now, this is a layered architecture as well, right? And this is a more universal kind of architecture. This is more like the internet, more like our computers. So it isn't that garments, so I draw, this is another problem. We gotta find a different way of drawing this. Garments don't sit on top of clothing. They don't sit on top of, fiber gets made into thread, gets made into cloth, gets made into garment. But the thread is still there, right? And so we get really confused about this because we might know how fibers work and we might know how this works, and then we don't realize what the intermediate layers, which is what our whole meeting is about in neuroscience, what are these intermediate layers? And so one thing you can do is you can just like cram these together at random and you get paper, right? Which is okay, but it's not clothing, right? So what you've got to do is you've got to make sure these things don't unravel, right? So you got to really lock them in, right? And they have to stay hidden. If the fibers in my outfit start unraveling, that's a source of fragility, right? Same with our brains. So it's large, it's hidden, large, thin, and extremely non-convex. All this stuff is hidden in normal operation. I mean, it's not, you can see it, but it has to, its fiber identity has to be lost in the thread, which has to be lost in the cloth, and has to be lost in the garment. Okay. So now you get these horizontal networks of garments. I think I got a better picture of this. Yeah, okay. So you got this horizontal kind of stacking together of things. You've got, down here you might have a horizontal network of fibers, and then you can have a horizontal network of garments, and then there's this vertical decomposition. And there's nothing mystical about this. There's nothing hard about this. That's why I put this up here, because everybody understands this. But you can just take this and plug in a cell, and it, craziness, right? Or the brain, craziness, right? So you're going to start, who knows what you're doing with this stuff. But anyway, okay. So there are universal strategies, right? So the garment really, you really don't want to have access to the unconscious, right? You want it to just work. If you do get access, you will screw it up. Right? You don't want to have access to your threads. Leave them alone, right? there's a lot of constraints on cross-layer interaction, right? You don't want to, you only want fibers to be in threads, you only want threads to be in cloth, and you only want it to be in that way, right? So you print unraveling. Even though garments seem analog continuous, there's lots of quantization down here. There's lots of digitalness in this. What makes a weave? What makes a knit? Very digital. Very quantized. So you see quantization coming up in intermediate scales. Don't know about the brain. Certainly in cells, you have lots of quantization. That's what, you know, DNA does. What's, the other thing is, though, is that you got these very... these constraints of deconstraint. You do the same thing no matter what, but there's enormous diversity in what you can do with those. So the amount of things you can sew from fabric is huge, but you have only a few different sewing strategies, only a few knits and weaves, only a few different spins. Very, so we could draw this as a bunch of, but see, there's not one waist, there's a bunch of waists to this hourglass, right? Or if you turn it sideways, it would be bow ties. Now, of course, a lot of stuff we can now, one of the things we can do is now we can go, hell, a function, man. We'll just build stuff, right? We'll just make crap. But if you didn't have this architecture, right, this robust architecture, you couldn't make these silly, fragile garments, right? Like, yeah, like that. I really like that one. Okay, so this is, yeah. I think those are some Caltech students. Anyway, so, okay. Is it scalable and sustainable? That's kind of one of the issues, right? Okay, so what does this have to do with the brain? Let me try to finish with that. So the idea is that we have a layered architecture, cells, organs, and physiology, and the cells, there's layering within those. But the brain also has these layers, which I'm just making cartoons out of. And notice these are orthogonal, right? There's still the neuron layer but within this, but then there's these big slabs of brain. And here's the interesting thing. There's a lot more arrows going this way than this way, right? So vision, right? You think, oh, well, there must be a lot of wires going from your eye to your brain. Nah, there's hardly any. They almost all go the other way. Why is that? Because you're sending out, because this is what matters, right? And all you're sending back is errors. So we don't know a lot about what goes on in between, but we heard some interesting talks last week about it. So here's one of the things you do automatically, right? Here's a bowl of fruit. Face, right? Right? Some people don't see a face, right? Some people just see two bowls of fruit. But we pick out a face really quickly, right? And it's the same picture, right? Just, oh, now it's the other way around. Okay. Which line is longer? Obviously the one on the left is. Now they're the same length. Now the one on the right is. And what Dale Purvis says is, the one on the right is longer. Okay, so you've projected this thing into two dimensions to trick me. But if I ever encounter this in the real world, that one's farther away and it's longer. And that's the right answer, according to Dale. And I kind of think he's right. This is the cool one. And so you get a group together and most of them are Confederates, and they say, oh, that's longer. And then the last person goes, that's longer. A lot of people do that. Some of us probably don't. There's some of us probably, but if they all said that was longer, they go, well, I'm gonna say that one's longer, right? But there's a purpose to that as well, right? There's a reason why. It's sort of like if everybody's eating these berries and no one's eating those berries, you don't go, I'm gonna try these berries, right? You say, has anybody tried these berries? Okay. So what we have is that we have this fast, limited scope. And that's practically everything. And then we have this broad, slow, broad scope. So as a consequence, we've got to push action down to the periphery as much as we can. But we don't know much about how this works. So let me go back to this, right? This is kind of a trivial point, but learning to select an appropriate outfit is harder than actually assembling one, right? You can tell kids here, put this on, and they, and you know, put your coat on. Again, in Santa Barbara, you have to worry about this stuff, but that's one reason to live here. But in other parts of the world, when kids are, there's a point at which kids have to wear the right layering of clothing, or they're going to die when they go to school. Like they'll actually die, right, if you don't get it right. And so parents do this, and then the kids learn to do this, and then eventually they learn to do this. But then there's always this: you're not going to the house in that, are you? Right. So same thing here. If you look at the manufacturing process, there's supply this way and demand this way. But this, the complexity is way bigger here. This is just manufacturing, right? Supply chain management is where all the complexity is. So all the arrows go the other way, right? Okay, so let me just end with I'm going to take a couple more minutes and end with a couple Because not only does Dittol's reviewers think I'm completely full of it, but so do these guys, right? The PETA age. The end of theory. So we've heard this before. Our simulations are so good we don't have to think anymore, right? The end of theory. So it is model. Yeah. So the point is, if you have enough data, you can. You don't have to think anymore. You don't need theory anymore, right? So I've started a new thing called this pedophilia, and I want you to join my campaign to save our children and stop pedophilia. So, what is pedophilia? It's the perverse love of data and computation, right? A pedophop is someone who profits from pedophilia. And then, inspired by this Homer Simpson, exodus is loss of clue from excessive pedophilia. So that's here. So I like making up new words. So we want to stop pedophilia. And so you can say that, and most people will go, well, yeah. And they say, no, well, yeah, okay. And then if you explain it to them, they'll still say you should stop it, maybe. Okay. And there's a treatment, but it's not yet in widespread use. You just have to actually get a clue. But it's, again, not widespread use. So let me just say, one of the problems, so where do we get this, what's an, one of the problems that we get, where does pedophilia come from and where are some flaws in it, right? So if you want to see the math, is the math of the internet, and here's more math of the internet. Oh, so it has a layered architecture. Let me just say one little thing about this. Okay, there's something really wrong with it. What is an op? So how does our laptop layer? So that's another example, which is a classic example. You got hardware, actually you got digital sitting on analog, but you have hardware, you have an operating system, and then you have your applications running in your operating system. There's very little diversity here. There's lots of diversity here and here, right? What does the OS have to do? It has to manage all these resources, right? And you have to have strict layering. You have to keep separate the application namespace. So if you write programs, you name things. And then there's a virtual address space, and then there's an actual physical address space. And those are all very separate. They're absolutely kept separate, right? So basically, in programming, no global variables. In operating systems, don't cross layers. Absolutely don't. Because if you do, your things will crash, and that would never happen with one of these. Okay. You never want to allow that. You never want to have applications have direct access. Problems with leaky layering, global variable disaster, poor protocol activations, all these things, right? Actually, the reason I don't like it is because our theory doesn't work very well. Because you can't make it robust if it can't be made robust, right? If it's way far off the curve, you can't do anything about it. So you've seen these IP addresses, you know, 192.168.1.1, that stuff. What do they know? They don't even name nodes, they name interfaces, which is a source of confusion. But when you ask, so, when you type in a URL and you go out and get the IP address, this a domain name service gives that to you. What does it give you? It gives you a physical address at the other side of the network. So you can send crap to this guy he doesn't want. This is a disaster. You can't, so the point is you can't fix it, right? There's no math that will fix this. It's just broken. And the reason this happened was they built this thing when they had like 8 of these, right? And everybody was trusted. And the last thing you had to worry about was, you know, malicious users and stuff, because you'd shoot them, right? What you're worried about was somebody bombing one of these things, right? Well, that's not the world we live in anymore, but we haven't upgraded it. So you get these, yeah, so what you see is that it works great, right? Once you do anything like this, right? If you're first to market with an OS, like Windows, and you run diverse applications on it, you get this locked in. So now we're locked into the internet architecture. We're locked into Windows and Linux and Apple. And that's where this hourglass comes from. And that, you can't avoid this, but at the same time, we need to manage it more explicitly. We don't want to have it happen by accident. If it happens by accident, we get stuck with things we don't like. So all the problems, all these, if you know about any of this stuff, NATs, what are NATs doing? NATs are attempting to get rid of the global address space, right? Firewalls, all this, anyway. Architecture is not graph topology. The most non-architectural thing about this is the graphs. Why? The whole point of a layered architecture is I can make any graph I want. You know, make up scale-free world, right? And make up anything you want. The whole point is the architecture makes it possible for you to do anything you want. Now, if you build a physical layer that is terrible, it won't work very well, but it's allowed. So all these graphs are completely arbitrary. Architecture, the thing that architecture is most not is graph topology. Okay, that's my rant. Oh, if you want to read more about this, that's another PNS paper. This paper is a complete rant, even by my standards. Okay, like Walter Willinger, oh, yeah, like get him going. Whew. He's great, though. I mean, he's really great. But, okay. So, last joke. So, it can be worse than that, right? It can be much worse than all this stuff, right? Because there's new sciences of complexity in networks, and it's like edge of chaos, self-awareness, all this stuff, right? Creation science, intelligent design sounds like a good thing, right? The problem is the words get stolen from us. Science now means what, right? What is intelligent science? Sounds like a great idea. So yeah, I'm in favor of intelligent design. Oh, really? You can be teaching in your school? Yeah, cool. And then they come in, you go, well, wait a second, right? Financial engineering, risk management, all this stuff. This stuff is all kind of pure passion, right? Whoops. That's what happens when you get carried away. It's funny because we've got this robust architecture called science, and it kind of gets hijacked every once in a while. Tons of books on it. You go to the bookstore, and this is what people think complexity is, right? You know, it's been, everything's wrong about it, right? Minimal impact on technology. Nobody thinks the internet's, nobody who actually work on the internet thinks it's scale-free. I think in medicine, it's really a concern, though, because there's a lot, and I think neuroscience now is coming in like a tsunami, so warning. So here's the thing is, even small amounts of this stuff can create bewildering complexity, right? So you can create incredible fragility. You take, in fact, nonlinear dynamics with feedback is practically synonymous with chaos, right? So the question is, how do we build robust systems? By not making them mildly nonlinear, by making them extremely nonlinear, by making them extremely non-equilibrium, extremely all these things, right? These are all mild, and this is all extreme. But it's organized, right? It's controlled, it's organized, it's structured, it's architected. So that's what architecture is really about. So the point is, turbulence is a highly nonlinear phenomenon, right? Well, nonlinear there just means I'm confused and I'm trying to confuse you, right? It turns out all these words have this second meaning, right? And the second meaning is the same. It's an emergent, highly emergent, nonlinear, blah, 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 right? All I'm trying to do is confuse you. So I want to take these words, I want nonlinear to mean not linear, right? And I want to be able to say, Navier-Stokes is mildly nonlinear, my laptop is extremely nonlinear, and being able to make that precise, right? So we need a word for the second meaning, since it's all the same, right? So I have a new word called emergent. So now you get people to say, oh, it's a highly emergent phenomenon. And that just means, I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. Then you can say cool things like, emergence at the edge of chaocritoplexity. So of course, you got to get people to start using this without irony. I don't know how to do that. It did come back to me. I met some guy at a meeting. He said, oh, I'm really sorry you didn't come to this other meeting. I said, yeah, I couldn't make it. He said, you might not have liked it. There was a lot of emergence there. And I go, where did you hear that? And it'd be, you know, I'd heard it around in a loop. And there's, you know, somebody at MIT has got an emergent.org already reserved as well. So it's kind of catching on. And you might try to guess. It's a combination of two words. The first is emerge, but there's lots of endings that this could come from. So you can try to guess what that is. So now we can say, okay. Oh, by the way, irreducible. Let me just end with. I'm really sorry. I'm going to go ahead with irreducible. So you know about irreducible intelligent design. Here's the argument, right? Rube Goldberg, right? So the idea is, if biology is like this, then it could not have evolved, right? It had to be designed by a pretty nasty designer. I mean, nasty designer. But anyway, it's actually true. If this, you know, as a syllogism, if biology is like this, then it could not evolve. That's actually true. But if biology is like this, then it's too fragile to persist, right? You'd have to constantly be intervening because it's going to fall apart, right? Constant intervention of supernatural forces, not creation, right? You need constant intervention. Okay, so problem is this is a cartoon. You can't actually build this. All those people do pretty amazing things. There's these competitions that engineers have to build things that look like this. most of the biologists, but like the point is, whoever said otherwise, right? Well, actually, lots of scientists, lots of biologists say, oh, it's kind of a, biology is kind of like a Rube Goldberg device. Stop saying that, right? It confuses people, right? And then they start believing you, and they go, oh, well, then there's no way this could evolve. That's true, right? So we gotta stop doing that. Now it is true, we are too fragile and sustainable. I mean, we do build systems that are way too much like this, right? But, okay, I'm sorry I ran over. I will stop.
Physicists often talk about the basic laws of physics as a kind of layered structure. We're up here, we've got classical physics, fluid mechanics. Down below there, molecules. Below that, there's another layer of atoms.
Yeah.
Then we've got quantum mechanics, and then we've got quantum field theory, and below that there's...
Then you got like worms and strings and...
And the idea of the multiverse, right, that there are a lot of different pocket universes, gives some possibility for these laws to vary from place to place. So what's the analog of robustness and fragility?
So, okay. As if I wasn't irresponsible speculating enough, I'm gonna like take it to, so here's the deal is, why does this universe have the laws it does? Robustness.
But what does robustness mean in this context?
What robustness means in this context is...
You mentioned before energy was conserved. That's true.
Yeah, that's true, right. So robustness would mean the laws of God allow large-scale matter to assemble at all. Most laws don't, right? Most parameters, you know, okay, I don't know this stuff, I don't know this area, but I've been told by my physicist friend. First of all, the fact that it's layered means I think it's possibly that we can fix the theory. That's what we're working on. But given the theory even as it stands, I think there's claims that if you tweak some of the basic parameters, it's very hard to get a coherent universe. Stuff craps out and just makes hydrogen or doesn't even do that or something, right? So there's people who say that's true. So I think what needs to be maybe added to the mix is, of course, then how do they get tuned? And then you can have your argument about intelligent design. But the parameters have to be tuned so that coherent structures emerge. And so you could say, if I want coherent structures, coherent structures are only robust in some small neighborhood of our current universe, perhaps. That's doable. I mean, you could look at that given, the problem is this stuff is really not equal. It's this kind of non-equilibrium, right? It's not this kind of non-equilibrium, right? Which is non-equilibrium. That's like the tornadoes. It's more like airplanes, right? Airplanes are like this, and they're really different. And so we have to get that part, I think, right. But I think robustness has to play a role if you take that point of view. The other thing is, if you don't think there's a multiverse that just happened this way, then you don't have to explain anything. So.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Could you give like a 2-second description of what you mean by convex?
If I have two objects in a set and I take their average, it's still in the set. And so, unfortunately, very little of the world is nicely convex. And so most of engineering is taking problems that are horribly non-convex and figuring out how to rearrange it and embed it in higher dimensions and da-da-da to turn it into a convex problem. Okay. So all the natural parameterizations of control systems, of nervous systems, of everything are horribly non-convex in the sense that, and that's what Eve was saying, right? We take a working set of parameters, we take another working set of parameters, we take their average and it doesn't work anymore. So she says, can we use averaging as a technique in neuroscience if the objects of study are not convex? Good point. Yeah?
You had zombies in the title.
Oh! Yeah, so Mike and Scott basically say we're zombies, right? Because we think we're conscious, but we're not, right? Because all we're doing, so here's the idea, is that all we're doing is we're living our lives, but we're narrating. So you know what a dream? So seeing is dreaming. Basically, all you're ever doing is dreaming. Sometimes you match the dream to reality sort of vaguely, but all you're ever doing is narrating your life. You're never making any real decisions, and that's why we're all zombies. I've not quite said it as eloquently as they would say it. But they don't say we're zombies. The question is, what really is the difference between we're just automatons running, and they have, the evidence that they have for this is scary, like really scary, right? And so the lack of free will. But then I ask, like, what am I trying to be free of? I mean, I just want to get the right answer every time. And if I can do that, you know, in lower cortex, fine. So I don't know what I want free will for. I just want to get the right answer. And so I think what I can use free will for is to train better, to get better answers, right? It's like, you know, it's like racing. I just want to get faster. I don't care if I decide. I just want to go as fast as I can. So I'm not sure free will is actually a useful thing. I just think we want to get, I think we, our problem isn't lack of free will. Our problem is that we make stupid choices, right? We got to, that's what we got to stop doing. And if we can stop making stupid choices by training ourselves to not want to do stupid things, that would be great. I haven't done that yet. I still do incredibly stupid things, but I think that's the thing. And so Mike and Scott talk about this a lot of this, you know, are we zombies? Are we just narrators of our own lives? And they make a pretty persuasive case, I think.
I think it should be said, though, that those experiments about free will are really about very short time scale actions. They're not about deliberative. You're thinking of the so-called readiness potential.
But I knew you were going to say that.
I think one should keep that in mind. I think it's important because people always mistake control theory for something.
It's a question, not an answer. It's a question, not an answer. I mean, yeah, I think it's just fun, you know. And plus, if you can take anything now and add and zombies, right, and make a movie out of it, right? So I'm hoping that my whole thing will get made into a movie for, you know, like seven-figure deal, but I don't exactly. So I was really bummed when they didn't do a podcast on this theorem, right? Because I could just imagine. So what's your science paper about? Well, the integral of the law, you know, on the podcast anyway. So, yeah.
You said the brain is designed to create actions.
Yeah.
You said some people don't agree with you. What are the other opinions?
Well, the brain computes fundamentally. Or the brain is an information processing system, whatever that means. The point is, the brain does have to do some computation, or it has to do some communication. But the doing communication for the purpose of control is very different than, say, burning a CD, right? So if I want to burn a CD, I want to compress the files, and then I want to do error correcting so if it gets scratched, it still works, right? And the theory to do that is the most beautiful theory in all of engineering. It's gorgeous, right? It is, and once you see that theory, it's hard to ever think of anything else as being good, and control theory is a mess by comparison, right? The problem is, if I got to do that all really quick, then I don't do it that way. Right, and so if we live in this virtual world, we can do compression and all this kind of stuff, but that's not how our brains work, right? Our brains are doing computation and communication to take action. That's it. Now we can sit around here and do other things, okay? And I think we've had decades of metaphors for the brain that came out of technology that were just misleading, horribly misleading. So I talk about layered architectures and my laptop's layered, but that's the only thing my laptop has in common with our brain. Otherwise, it's completely different, right? It is layered, and this hidden layering, all that kind of stuff. So metaphors are dangerous, right? That's the thing, I think, and that's the main. But you know, I mean, practically everything I said, I'm sure there's people here that would say completely wrong, right? I mean, every but I think every part of it, I think I could find people who would say that piece is right, I didn't understand the next slide. But at least every piece up here is defensible by somebody. So, because I'm a systems guy, I don't worry about the components. We're going to have a whole discussion at 2, so why don't we let people go?
Yeah, I think we should maybe
allow
people to actually.
Let people.
To choose to leave you.
But I'm happy to stay and talk.
And others can stay. And I think the there any discussion is
good. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.